final argument this morning is Lauren Poirier, appellant, versus South Dakota Department of Revenue and Regulation, which is the appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Vanya Hogan, who's an attorney from St. Paul. And for the Department of Revenue, we have Megan Jo Sunstegard, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself in this matter, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. Ms. Hogan, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Vanya Hogan, and I represent Bat Poirier, doing business as Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc., and Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc. We're before the court for the third time in this case. The first time we were here in Poirier 1, the court ruled, first, that the state of South Dakota could not impose its motor fuel tax on tribal members on their reservations, and that the prior imposition of the tax was illegal and unconstitutional. And secondly, that motor fuel consumers, not motor fuel marketers like Mr. Poirier, bore the legal incidence of the tax so that Mr. Poirier's customers were entitled to the bulk of the refund that he had originally requested. The second time we were here, in Poirier 2, the court ruled that a 15-month statute of limitations applied so that Poirier's claims from December of 1997 to December of 1999 and not the claims for prior time periods, were timely. Interestingly, the court found that those claims were timely, even though they had been filed as marketer refund claims. The court found they were timely both for Mr. Poirier and for his tribal member customers. Ever since the court issued its decision in Poirier 2 in 2004, Poirier has been attempting to amend his motor refund claims, which he brought, as I said, on his own behalf as marketer refund claims, to convert them to consumer refund claims on behalf of a class of his Oglala Sioux tribal member customers. In addition, he wants to amend his claims to add in the marketer refund claims he filed from January of 2000 through the end of November 2003, when the department finally implemented this court's Poirier 1 decision and stopped imposing the tax on tribal members. The reason for Poirier's motion is very simple. Without it, not a single one of his customers has or will receive a refund. And here's why. For a customer to receive a refund in South Dakota, he or she is supposed to apply for and receive a consumer refund license and then file a consumer refund claim that is supported by detailed receipts on a certain kind of paper, no less. The record in this case shows that the average motor fuel sale at Big Bats Texaco, as it was then called, is only about $5. That means the average refund is going to be less than a dollar. It's unlikely that any consumer is going to bother applying for a claimant license and filing a refund claim for less than a dollar.
How much, say the gallon of gas in those days was a buck, I don't know what it was, how much of that was that disputed tax, like 6 cents, 8 cents? What was it?
It's 22 cents a gallon.
Okay.
So,
if you got 10 gallons, $2.20.
Right.
Okay.
But interestingly, well, as I said, the record here shows that people aren't filling up their tanks at Pine Ridge. They are putting in $5 of gas at a time. The record also shows that only 9% of the sales at Big Bats were by credit card, which is typically the only time you get a receipt when you buy gas. Not only are the sales small for small amounts, and hardly any of them are credit card sales, but by the time this court ruled in Poirier 1 in 2003 and in Poirier 2 in 2004 that it was the consumers and not the marketer who were entitled to the refund, the sales at issue from December 1997 to December 1999 were 4 to 7 years old. So not only would these consumers have had to get receipts in the first place, they would have had to hold on to them for 4 to 7 years if they applied the day that Poirier 2 came down to get a refund.
How would it be easier for Mr. Poirier to make these claims on their behalf?
Pardon?
Why would it be easier for Mr. Poirier to make these claims on behalf of the class?
Because if under a class, if a class action is permitted and the prerequisites of a class are met, which is not really an issue before the court today, the courts do not have to fine each and every one of those customers, determine exactly how much each and every one of them paid in motor fuel taxes, and make sure that they get the exact amount that they paid in taxes. But there's a kind of recovery called, I'm not sure the pronunciation, but I think it's something like CyPress, which allows fluid recovery. So that's what often happens in class actions, where it's impossible to track down how much each individual claimant is actually owed.
But he would have the records to show all these payments.
Exactly. He filed marketer refund claims and has the invoices for all the motor fuel taxes that we're talking about here that were paid between December of 1997 and, under our theory, up through the end of November of 2003.
The total, but not by customer.
Correct. So we know, and the department has been on notice for years, of what the total tax amount is that we're talking about. We just don't know how much each individual customer spent.
Is it as uncontested then, the totals? As far as you know.
Well,
maybe you don't know.
I think that there's no, the total amount of tax that Poirier prepaid and that he paid under protest is not contested. We would probably have some dispute that would have to get worked out, if the amendment is allowed, about what percentage of those sales were to tribal members. But there's a couple different ways we can figure that out. There was a survey done in the case that showed about 90% of Poirier's customers are Oglala Sioux tribal members. And the state of South Dakota has since entered into a tax agreement with the Oglala Sioux tribe for the collection of motor fuel taxes, under which 96% of motor fuel taxes that are collected on the reservation are returned to the tribe, and 4% go to the state. So there's a couple of different percentages there we would have to work with.
Shifting gears for a minute, class action is found in 15-6, which is our civil procedure code for trials in circuit courts. You are asking us to now apparently adopt that concept to a 126 administrative proceeding. Has this ever been done before?
Well, I don't think it's been done before for a motor fuel tax refund. We certainly didn't find any other cases like that. In 2002, though, there was a class action brought by a group of folks in Rapid City, I think people who had paid tax at the Rapid City Regional Airport, who tried to bring a class action for a refund of sales taxes, and this court allowed that case to go forward, even though it was for the recovery of sales taxes.
That was brought as a class action. It wasn't brought as a recovery for under administrative appeal, right?
I believe that's correct. That case, Beck versus Rapid City, did start as a class action. But there is a statute, Title 1, Chapter 26, Section 32.1 of the Administrative Procedure Act that says you can apply the rules of civil procedure as long as they're not in conflict with the rules regarding the administrative proceedings. It's important to keep in mind.
Do you want to take your water up with you?
That might be a good idea.
We don't want to turn this into an endurance contest.
Thank you. It's important to keep in mind the standard that is before the court today. We're not here to decide whether Poirier's customers should be allowed to recover under a class action. We're simply here to determine whether Poirier should be allowed to amend his claims. And the standard for whether to allow amendments is an extremely liberal one. Leave to amend shall be freely granted when justice so requires. And the way that that's been interpreted is that a motion to amend should be granted unless the non-moving party can show that it will be unduly prejudiced by the amendment. That's a standard that both the circuit court and the department and hearing examiner ignored. The department didn't show that it would be unduly prejudiced. And as I just mentioned a moment ago, the department has been on notice of the amount of tax refunds we're talking about here for years. It's just that if the class action is allowed to go forward, the plaintiffs might actually recover if they force every single individual tribal member to file a refund. They won't actually ever have to pay it out. And in fact, in all the years since Poirier 1 was issued, which we're coming up on 7 years now, not one single one of Mr. Poirier's tribal member customers has gotten a refund. Keeping that liberal standard in mind, there's three roadblocks that the department says block this attempt to amend the claims. One, which we touched on, was kind of the procedural rule and the fact the department says the state's limited waiver of sovereign immunity isn't broad enough to allow a class action. The second roadblock, they say, is that the scope of the remand orders in Poirier 1 and Poirier 2 simply aren't broad enough to allow a class action. And third, the department says that the 15-month statute of limitations would block an amendment at least to allow Poirier's 2000 to 2003 claims to be brought as a class action. And I want to address each of those roadblocks in turn. The first, and I think the most significant, is probably the allegation that the state hasn't waived its sovereign immunity for this kind of a claim. The state's waiver of sovereign immunity for tax refunds is found in Title 10, Chapter 59, which is the chapter on uniform administration of certain taxes, including motor fuel taxes. And the waiver language in particular is found in Section 17, which says, in relevant part, no court has jurisdiction of a suit to recover such taxes, penalty, or interest unless the taxpayer seeking the recovery of tax complies with the provisions of this chapter. Now, if you look through this chapter, which is Chapter 59 of Title 10, there aren't any procedures that apply to motor fuel tax refunds. They're found in a different chapter. The only procedure that arguably applies to motor fuel tax refunds is in Section 20, where it simply says that you have to make a recovery, you have to pay the tax under protest. Now, the department says these consumers weren't paying the tax under protest, and that's likely true. But in Poirier 1, this court held in paragraph 29 that Muddy Creek maintained standing to bring the suit based on the fact that regardless of where the legal incidence falls, Muddy Creek was liable for the tax as it was required to prepay it, even though it passed the tax on to its customers. So Poirier was the taxpayer. Because he was the taxpayer, that's why he filed these refund claims. And even though he passed the tax on to his customers, the court said he had standing to raise the claims for those customers.
I thought that was just for the gas that he consumed personally. He'd be more of a tax collector, wouldn't he be, for the consumers that filled up their cars?
Well, he was the tax collector, but he was also the taxpayer. The way it works is he actually paid the tax the moment he imported it from the terminal rack into Nebraska. He paid the tax before it got to his station for him to sell to his customers. And then the tax got passed on to his customers once he sold it at his station. But he did prepay that tax. He was the taxpayer, even though he didn't bear the legal incidence of the tax.
So it's different than a gross receipts tax, necessarily, is it?
Yes. I mean, I think this is an unusual situation where you have more than one taxpayer. You've got the marketer who has to prepay it on behalf of the customers, and then you've got the customers themselves who are also paying the tax.
So, say if nobody bought his gas, he'd have been stuck not only with the gas but with paying the tax.
That's true. There are certain limited refund procedures whereby a marketer can get some of the taxes paid back for things like shrinkage of the fuel, but generally, we didn't sell it all isn't a basis for getting a tax refund if you're a marketer.
Ms. Hogan, how do you started to talk about where the waiver was in the chapter, but I don't know how the Constitution is clear that state can't be sued unless the legislature approves it. And then you talked about 10, 59, 17, and 20. How do you get to the point that it's been authorized?
Because Section 17 says Section 17 says you have to comply with the provisions of this chapter, which is Chapter 59. The provisions of that chapter are simply paying the tax under protest, which is what Poirier did. And he was the taxpayer for these taxes, just like his customers were. The other very important point with respect to sovereign
immunity. So you're saying that really, because he's the taxpayer, he complied with what he needed to do, and therefore he can proceed?
Right. He can proceed as a representative of the class.
But how do you piggyback the class onto the fact that I thought you just said he was the taxpayer? Now you're getting me confused, I guess.
He pays the tax, but he doesn't bear, as this court found in Poirier 1, he doesn't bear the legal incidence of the tax. And that's not it's not unusual. We cited a couple of other cases from other jurisdictions where courts have expressly found that there can be more than one taxpayer. There can't be more than one entity bearing the legal incidence of the tax, but there can be more than one taxpayer. The other important point here is to look at the class action rule. The class action rule, until 1982, read pretty much like all class action rules did. Rule 23A of the Rules of Civil Procedure, which listed out the prerequisites to a class action, that the class be so numerous that you can't join everybody, that there are common questions of law and fact, that the claims or defenses of the representative are typical of the claims and defenses of the class, and that the representative parties will fairly represent the class. Those were the prerequisites until 1982. In 1982, the South Dakota legislature stepped in and amended what was formerly just a procedural rule and added a fifth prerequisite, which is that the suit is not against the state for the recovery of a tax imposed by, and they listed out 10 different chapters. Notably, the motor fuel chapter, which was then Title 47, then it became Title 47, or Chapter 47, is now Chapter 47B, was not included on that list. Under rules of statutory construction, when the legislature makes a list of things and includes some things and excludes others, courts have to take it that that was done intentionally. It must mean something that the South Dakota legislature says you can't bring a class action for these certain kinds of taxes, but didn't say that with respect to motor fuel taxes. The legislature amended section or Rule 23A again in 1985.
So you're saying by implication they waived sovereign immunity?
Well, I think there's an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity in Title 59 that we have complied with. And I'm saying that under Rule 23A, the legislature hasn't said you can't bring a class action for motor fuel tax refunds. They said you can't do it for some kind of taxes, but they didn't say you can't do it for motor fuel taxes. So for that reason, the sovereign immunity of the state should not preclude this, the amendment of the pleadings to allow the class. The second roadblock that the department tries to erect is that the scope of the remands are too narrow. They say, look, it doesn't say in the remand orders that you can bring a class action and that you can't just reopen an entire case on rehearing. And they cite a case called NRA Conditional Use Permit,
well,
which is a case.
In Poirier 1 and 2, though, class actions never came up, did they?
No, it didn't come up.
Right.
But the court did talk in its remand instructions about determining how much was owed to Poirier and how much was owed to Poirier's customers.
For their personal use.
For their personal, yep.
Specific language was in the remand.
Yes. For Poirier, to determine, I'm trying to
I'm
find the
I'm looking at paragraph 8 of Poirier 2.
Right. So that there was a remand for Poirier to show how much motor fuel he purchased as a consumer so that he could get back. But the court goes on to add four more sentences right after that about how he has standing to raise the claims for his consumers and they should get the money back. Now, I'm not trying to argue that the court anticipated a class action. What I'm saying is the court didn't preclude a class action and that the only way that we're going to effectuate what this court said in Poirier 1 and Poirier 2, which is that the tax was unconstitutional and illegal and that the state shouldn't keep it, is if we do this class action.
Because aren't you asking us to do something that that no court has ever done before to take a tax administrative tax appeal and convert it into a civil action. And you have no authority for that. You have no case where a court has done that. Isn't that what you're asking us to do here? It's the right thing to do. We recognize that these folks have a right to this tax, and it's the right thing to do. But there's no statute, no procedure, and no precedent for ever having done it.
Well, there isn't. That's correct. I think that just shows what an unusual case this is, where it started by one person who prepaid the tax on behalf of everybody, and the court said, nope, sorry, there should be a refund, but you're not the person who should get it. And I'm not arguing that there is something in the South Dakota rules that says you can convert it to a class action. But there is a statute in the Administrative Procedure Act that says you can apply the rules of civil procedure if they don't conflict. And here, our point is, there's enough flexibility that they don't conflict, and that an unusual case like this calls for an unusual remedy.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Ms. Sonstegard, you have 20 minutes. You could take your water, too.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. This court has made two decisions in this case and has made some very specific remand instructions and orders to the department. After poor year one, this court remanded the case to decide three things: to determine the correct amount of motor fuel tax refund, or the correct amount of invalid tax refund as it applies to the purchases of Muddy Creek for its use on the reservation; two, to determine, upon proper application, the correct amount of invalid tax refund that applies to purchases by reservation Indian consumers; and three, to determine related questions such as prejudgment interest. After Poirier 2, this court decided that Poirier's consumers may be deemed to have their claims considered timely to the extent that Muddy Creek's claims were considered timely, and remanded for a hearing to determine what Poirier and Muddy Creek can prove as the amount of motor fuel tax they paid as consumers for their own personal use. The department attempted to do exactly what this court has ordered. As to Poirier, we made multiple attempts to ask Poirier, or to get Poirier, to tell us how much tax was owed to him due to this invalid tax. And it wasn't until well over a year after the Poirier 2 decision that Poirier actually gave us an inkling as to what was paid, as demonstrated at AR 2-730. The department originally sent a check to Poirier on March 3rd for the taxes that he gave us an idea as to how much, March 3rd, 2005. Poirier did not accept the check. And it wasn't until September of 2007, over three and a half years after this court's decision in Poirier 2, that Poirier allowed us to enter into a stipulation to tell us how much he was owed. So in October of 2007, the department sent the check. And Poirier, since October of 2007, has been paid in full and will never receive another check from the department for the refund of these motor fuel taxes. That stipulation is found at AR 2 784 to 788. And so as much as Poirier and Muddy Creek have made big about the fact that this case has taken over 10 years, it has been a tactical and strategic decision to not tell us how much he was owed in order to revive the claims that it lost to the Indian consumers. As to the Indians' consumers, the state recognized that we couldn't get every single dollar to every individual. In fact, it recognized that we had to pay back taxes to all the other tribal members and other locations and other reservations, locations where the tribe also had, or there were gas stations on the reservation. And So what the state and the governor decided to do was to go ahead and meet with the tribes and establish a mechanism to be able to reimburse the tribe for these collection of taxes. And these taxes are regulated under the Constitution in Article 11, Section 8, whereby these taxes can only be used for the maintenance, construction, and supervision of highways and bridges. And today, the state has already reimbursed $3 million on other reservations to seven different tribes. The state still has yet to pay the Oglala Sioux tribe, or reimburse the state, the tribe, for those taxes. And we will proceed, moreover, we will proceed to process any requests from the 1997 to 1999 time frame for any individual, any Indian consumer that can timely seek and prove their entitlement to these refunds.
Are you saying then that that the state's agreement to pay the Oglala Sioux tribe, reimburse the Oglala Sioux tribe, is equivalent to what a class action would have achieved if that were approved?
That's correct. And in essence, what the state has attempted to do was recognize that there was a problem, that this was an invalid tax, and that we have to fix the problem. And that was the state's response to reimburse the tribes to be able to, well, we can't figure out exactly who purchased the tax and actually put the gasoline into their car. We can determine who will be using or give money back to fix the highways and bridges in Indian country, because the individuals that paid the tax will be using those highways and bridges. And it was the best way to go about getting the money back to the people that it rightfully belongs to.
Well, but maybe an individual consumer didn't want better roads. Maybe they wanted to go buy bread and milk.
That is true. And the state will continue to process any claims submitted for the 1997 to 1999 time frame from here forward, or from Poyer 2 forward, so that the individuals that wanted the actual cash can get it.
So the agreements do not preclude an application by a consumer?
The tax collection agreements or the...
Well, the agreements you've got with the other tribes, you're
saying. Oh, that's correct. As to the location to Muddy Creek, that's correct. Just limited to Muddy Creek and Poyer.
So is there an agreement with that tribe then or not?
What happened was the governor met with the tribes and told them, we want to refund these, and they entered into, they went to the transportation, Department of Transportation.
But the members of, is it the Oglala?
Correct.
Has the tribe entered into an agreement on behalf of their members in this particular instance?
Not that I am aware of. I think we went to their government as a way to get the money back to them and ask them, is this the best way to go about it? And that was, determination was made that this was the best way that we could get the money back to them. And that money has been earmarked for the Oglala Sioux tribe to the tune of $1.2 million in Transportation Commission Resolution 17285 from December 29th, 2004, and that's in the administrative record second at 713 and 708. Now,
so what right now is just an offer. The tribe hasn't accepted that as that offer. $1.2 million that you say is being earmarked for the tribe is the state's offer to the tribe. The tribe hasn't agreed to accept that.
That is true, and outside of the record, I can say that we have been in conversations with the Oglala Sioux tribe as late as 2008 with regards to that, and 2009. Further, while the department has earmarked $1.2 million for the tribe, to reimburse them for work done in the highways and bridges. We will also pay any claims, again, from the 1997 to 1999 timeframe. But really, while this case has been taking so long, you really have to look at the record to determine why has it taken so long. And the record tells us quite a few things. Since this court's decision in 2004, Poyer has filed for the motion for leave to amend to commence a class action lawsuit, and that we went through quite a few different proceedings and that through circuit court and remanded down to OHE and back on up. And Poyer has attempted also to add the 2000 to 2003 time frame.
Help me understand what the length of time this has taken is relevant to the issues before the court.
Well, I believe what is relevant is that the state has done, or the department has done, everything in its ability to try and comply with this court's remands, and it has been extremely difficult to do that because of the legal maneuvering from Poyer by adding these other claims, adding the other time periods, and adding the, filing a petition for attorney's fees to the tune of $600,000.
Has there been a suggestion by other counsel that that is not a fact? I mean, that the department has not attempted to resolve it in the manner you suggested?
No, I don't think so. And I think it's
Let me ask you again. As it gets down to the heart of the issues that this court has to decide, what is the relevance?
That the remand orders tell us exactly what we need to do and that we are trying to follow exactly what this court decided. And that we haven't been able to do that until October of 2007 when we sent Poyer the check.
The remands didn't exactly address procedure, did they, and whether or not you could bring a class action as opposed to individual applications for refunds.
That's correct. The remand specifically looked at how much Poyer was due for motor fuel taxes that they paid as consumers for their own personal use in Poyer 2, and then we had the 3.
What is the problem of having a class action in a case like this with the department?
Well, Article 3, Section 27 of the South Dakota Constitution provides that the legislature shall direct by law in what manner and in what court suit may be had against the state. And so our legislature's answer to that specific constitutional mandate is found in 1059 and 1047B131.2, where they provide that the consumer may apply for and obtain a refund if a state court finds that the taxation of that purchase was unconstitutional. And then it comes back in 1059.17 that says no court has jurisdiction of a suit to recover such tax, penalty, or interest unless the taxpayer seeking that recovery complies with the provisions of this chapter.
Isn't this a rather unique case other than the individual? I mean, this is a unique case as far as trying to get the tax returned, isn't it?
I agree. However, the South Dakota Constitution provides in what manner and in what court that may be
handled. Can't be class actions.
That's correct. It doesn't say that. However, 1049 provides that no court has jurisdiction unless they follow the provisions in this chapter. Nowhere in 1047B or 1059 is there any discussion or implied provision that allows for explicit or express or otherwise that allows for a class action lawsuit. So claims are refunded pursuant to those procedures in 1059, we are limited by the provisions of 1059.17. Now, what Poyer has demonstrated or indicated is that in 1982, the legislature made an amendment to 15.6.23a, subsection 5. And also it amended that in 1985. However, what counsel had failed to point out to this court is that in 1986, the legislature came back and enacted 1059, the Uniform Administration of Certain State Taxes, and which relates very specifically to tax refund claims. And Poirier is asking this court to ignore the significance of that enactment in 1986 to 1059. Further, Poirier is asking you to ignore the fact that in 1996, 1047B was enacted, 1047B 131.2. And in 1996, this court said that they have to apply for and obtain the refund for that taxes, for taxes pursuant to that statute. The rules of civil procedure generally don't apply to tax refund claims or Administrative Procedures Act cases. Poirier claims that 126.32.1 allows for this court to consider Title 15 or 15.6.23a. However, it's only under certain circumstances that Title 15 may be considered, and it's only as far as Title 15 is consistent and applicable, and unless a different provision is specifically made for by this chapter or by the statute allowing such appeal. 15.6.23a is not consistent with the changes made in 1986 to 1059 and the changes made to 1047B in 1996. This is the more recent statute in 1047B and 1059, and it should control as opposed to those changes to 15.6.23a. It is specific as to the taxes in 1059.1, which includes 1047B. And further, it is not applicable because 1059 and 1047B do not permit tax class action refunds. The use of a class action in this case overreaches the judiciary's functions and undermines, and moreover, it undermines the legislature in the South Dakota Constitution, Article 3, Section 27. And I'd like to address some of your questions about the Beck case. I believe the Beck case is, that you asked to Ms. Hogan, I believe the Beck case is very different than this case. And it's more because in Beck, the legal incidence of the sales tax falls onto the retailer. And in that case, it was a group of retailers that were very identifiable in that case. Here, we have the legal incidence of the tax that falls on the ultimate consumer. And we don't know who those individuals are. As to what Justice Meyer Henry indicated about gross receipt tax, that is true as well, that the legal incidence of the gross receipt sales tax is on the retailer and makes it much more identifiable in that instance. Any claims that have been paid pursuant to 1047B 131.2 and 1059 from the 2000-2003 time period that was brought up earlier are not part of this record. And so there is no judicial determination for that time period as to if any individual was paid because they are not part of this case and it has not been part of the record and would only come into this case if this court decided it to be so. And moreover, the remand specifically called for the payment of claims from the 1997 to 1999 time period and not the 2000 to 2003. So in closing, even if Poirier is allowed leave to amend to include a class action lawsuit, Poirier cannot be an adequate representative in this case because he can't be an adequate representative because he's already been paid in full. He will never receive another dime and cannot adequately represent a class of unknown and unnamed individuals because he will never receive that money. And that will be my conclusion if there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Hogan, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to start off by addressing Ms. Sonstegard's argument that the fact that Title 10, Chapter 59, and Title 10, Chapter 47B were amended later than Rule 23A was, and that somehow that means that the fact that the legislature didn't say you can't bring a tax action for motor fuel refunds doesn't mean anything. But in fact, the fact that those two chapters were amended after the legislature amended the class action rule doesn't mean anything, because there is no conflict between Rule 23A and the procedures in Chapter 59 or in Chapter 47B. Neither Chapter 59 nor Chapter 47B says you can't bring a class action. And because the rules say that you can use the rules of procedure when there is no conflict, we can use Rule 23A to fill in what, in this case, this very unusual case, is a procedural gap. Next point I want to address is the fact that Poirier somehow dragged out this case by not accepting the check. At the time they first sent the check, we didn't know exactly how much was owed to Poirier or Muddy Creek. But part of the reason we didn't want to accept the money is we didn't want to accept a check and have them say, well, sorry, the whole case is over now. You can't raise these claims on behalf of your consumers, which they have now stipulated that isn't a problem. They stipulated when we finally did accept the check that Poirier still could raise the claims on behalf of his consumers. Ms. Sonstegard points out that the state isn't really trying to keep all the money it collected unconstitutionally, that in fact they've negotiated agreements with several of the tribes and that they've attempted to negotiate an agreement with the Oglala Sioux tribe. I would point out, however, that as the Justice has already noted, the Oglala Sioux tribe hasn't accepted that agreement. In addition, the amount that the department was offering to the Oglala Sioux tribe...
If they did accept it, would it affect your lawsuit?
I don't think it would accept our lawsuit, because if they want to give the tribe an extra $1.2 million, that's great. That doesn't mean they don't owe Poirier's customers. And the amount that they owe Poirier's customers is about $1.4 million. It's like $1,484,000 that is owed to the tribal member customers. So they're offering the tribe less than what is owed simply to Poirier's customers, and there were seven other gas stations operating on the Pine Ridge Reservation during this time. So it's no great bargain that they're offering this money to the tribe. And in addition, if Poirier's claims go forward, interest would be owing, and the interest at this point is slightly more than the amount of the actual claims.
Plus attorney fees in a class action.
Well, that would be left to be decided. I mean,
have you ever heard of a class action where attorney fees, significant attorney fees, weren't awarded?
I haven't looked at the issue. I think we would probably seek attorney's fees if the award is ever granted. I mean,
tell me what, you know, and I frankly don't understand how, presuming you would prevail here and the class action would proceed, how would Poirier distribute the money? What would he do other than, let's take into account the dispute as to the amount. How would the money be distributed much different than is currently being done in other reservations by agreement with the governor? Could you help me understand that?
Well, I will try to help understand that, but I will say preliminarily that we're not here to decide all of how the class action would proceed. It is very.
I understand that.
It is possible that we could reach some kind of an agreement with the department to say, okay, let's give the amount of this refund plus interest to the tribe, and the tribe can spend the money on behalf of its consumers.
Okay.
That could well happen. What I think would be different about it, unlike the settlement that they proposed to the tribe, is that there wouldn't be all these strings attached. Right now, for those tribes that did accept that money, they have to spend the money on road projects that the department pre-approves, and then the department will write them a check. They can't spend that money however they want.
Thank you for the clarification.
Now, there are some practical problems here. I assume some of these folks are probably, some are dead.
That could be. That happens in any kind of a class action. I mean, that's why there is a class action rule, because you can't always determine how much is supposed to go to each individual, especially when you're looking at very minute amounts of money at issue. I want to say a word about the 2000 to 2003 claims. At the time Poirier's case first came before the department for an actual hearing, it had been remanded there by Judge Sinter. And that was in February of 2000. The claim, the marketer refund claims that had been filed and denied up to that point, were claims through for sales through the end of 1999. But Poirier continued to file marketer refund claims every couple of weeks, or at least every month, until the department finally stopped imposing the tax on the tribal member customers. The only reason those later filed claims weren't in the case was simply that the case was already going on. Now, the department and Poirier realized that it wasn't going to make any sense for the department to deny every single one of those claims and make Poirier file a separate appeal so that the court's entire docket was clogged with motor refund claims. So in 2001, the department and Poirier entered into a stipulation, which is at tab O of our appendix, that said, we understand Poirier has already filed these additional marketer refund claims and that he's going to continue to file them until this case is done. And that the result in this case is very likely going to control what happens with those later filed claims. And so the department agreed that rather than denying each of those claims as they came in, they were going to hold them all in abeyance, issue a decision once this case was finally done, and then if Poirier felt the need to appeal, he could. The department doesn't dispute that Poirier timely filed every single one of those marketer refund claims from 2000 to 2003. He filed them easily within 15 months of when he paid the tax. This court ruled in Poirier 1 and 2 that Poirier's claims would be considered timely for his customers. Our point is that if the claims he filed for the time period 97 to 99 were timely for his customers, it makes no sense to say that the claims he filed for 2000 to 2003 were not timely for his customers, especially since the department stipulated it was going to hold on to those and just wait and decide them once this case was done. So for that reason, if the amendment is allowed to go forward as a class action, we believe that the 2000 to 2003 claims ought to be incorporated as well. There's just simply no difference between those claims and the earlier claims, except they didn't happen to make it into the case.
Who would oversee a class action? Would this be a hearing examiner within the Administrative Procedures Act, or are you going to have it in circuit court, or where is it going to be?
Well, I think that typically, because this started as an Administrative Procedure Act case, that it would get remanded back down to the department. What we have argued is that it should get remanded instead to the circuit court, because in our view, it's futile to go back to the department. They haven't ruled in Poirier's favor on one single issue in all of this litigation. In addition, it would drag the case out even more because we'd have to litigate it at the department, then appeal to the circuit court, and then...
Then we'd have Poirier 4.
Then we'd have Poirier 4. So we think that this is one of the rare cases where exhaustion of administrative remedies would be futile, and so that a remand should go to the circuit court rather than to the department.
Okay.
There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hogan. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.